Okay, the aficionados are here on Friday afternoon. But that's a nice piece of research. That's Machu Picchu. This afternoon we are leaving the developed part of the world, the rich world, with poor sites, and we are moving to the developing part of the world, the poor part of the world, with extremely rich sites. Two rich sites. And one is Machu Picchu, perhaps the most profitable site all over the world. And that's its major problem. So, we were trying to move. We have spent a lot of time and energy doing research in Italy. And more recently, in the last, we'll say, 5-6 years, we moved toward some sort of international comparison. And in this field, is we were talking at lunch or dinner last day, it's almost impossible to find a paper comparing two case studies from different countries. There's no international comparison at all. So this is what I really do try to develop in these years. And we'll try to look at Machu Picchu, try to understand the context, key actors, the role of plans. There have been two very important master plans in 1998 and in 2005. We're going to look at this to some extent. So, first, Machu Picchu, the nature of Machu Picchu, the administrative political context, and the set of conflicts of interest, of vested interest that are taking place around Machu Picchu. When you talk about Machu Picchu, all of us have the idea of the Inca city, of the beautiful Inca city lost in 1,800 meters over the sea. But it's also Machu Picchu is also a natural site. It's both heritage and natural site. And actually is one part of a very rich network of heritage inside the park and inside the province of Cusco. So the Vilcanota is an incredible set of beautiful archaeological sites. So, an extremely rich area, extremely articulated kind of heritage. And the political administrative context is what I like in this kind of research is when you're looking at, it's really a way of looking at total history. You cannot understand Machu Picchu if you don't understand the political and administrative context, as well as you don't understand Pompeii if you don't look at the political systems, or you don't understand the British Museum if you don't understand a bit of the debate or inside UK society as a whole. And this was, the Fujimori was a very critical period in Peru. It's a lot of privatization taking place, a lot of gifts to his friends and relatives, and it's really corruption and the most stupid way is outsourcing, in a sense. They were really giving the transportation to private, and they can make a lot of money on that. The hotel that is just in front of the site, which is a very expensive one, cost you $1,000 per night, is given for $6,000 per year as a rent to a private business. So you could run as in the Tuscany case with or without a società per azioni, you could have run. And after Fujimori, there was an interesting process of decentralization with a very complicated process of regulating public expenditure, which was basically a major anti-corruption. So basically any investment should be sent to Lima and fulfill a special procedure for investment, getting approval, getting check about individual unitary prices and costs that are set up, then come back and then you could execute it. So that is a very complicated procedure that will take a couple of years for any project to pass through. And it's also very interesting, you don't understand Machu Picchu if you don't understand what it is in terms of regulation of public expenditure. So, Machu Picchu is, from an institutional point of view, let me say in simple terms, is a mess. It's really a mess of different interests. It's a very complicated institutional context characterized by fragmentation. Fragmentation is a major issue in heritage. Institutional fragmentation, and it's something that is really causing serious problems to UNESCO, which is not very good in dealing with fragmentation. So you have three kinds of conflicts. One is between the local authority, first is, because it's a natural park and heritage, you have two different ministries that are involved. One is the forest ministry and the other is education with take care of the heritage. So basically you have two different local institutions, local branches of the two ministries that are involved. One is INC Cusco and the other is in Reina, I think it's the forestry. So you already have two different institutions that are posing a problem of integration. UNESCO are setting up a UNESCO site which has at least so far two different organizations and two different institutions that deal with. But this is not the only major conflict. What is really the major conflict is with the municipality of Aguas Caliente or Machu Picchu Pueblo, which is a crazy place if you have been there. It's really one of the worst set of construction you can see around the world, with no regulation, with no any kind of, both in terms of aesthetic or security or any kind of things. And people, there is not a local community in that sense. These are people that stay in Machu Picchu 2 or 3 years just to harvest short-term profit, then they go. I mean, the kids, they don't do at school because they are just staying for a few years and then they move as they come, they came, they go. So it's a, and the city as a mayor, as any city, which is one of the most dangerous, I would say, enemy of the protection of Machu Picchu, and he himself was in charge of illegal construction because of, you know, there is a very clear kind of setting rules, but it's the capability of controlling the territory is really marginal. It's like a Pompeii in a sense. I would like to write a paper comparing illegal behavior, mafia and narco traffic in Pompeii and Machu Picchu, but that's too much dangerous a paper. But, and also there is some sort of conflict, sometimes they are referring to, between the Andean kind of rationale versus what they call the Western bias, and there's a rhetoric of identity or local identity and Andean kind of identity in the last, particularly in the last period, while the previous plan was done by people, the same people, or people of the same region without any kind of attention against exploitation. Particularly, you know, when I'll come back later to the case studies. So, who are the case actors? INC Cusco, it's a huge organization, and it's very similar to an Italian superintendenza. They have the responsibility over the territory. So, Machu Picchu is just a part of a huge organization. So this is the the national. This is the local branches, if I remember correctly. Yes, this is the INS Cusco, and you know these are the many places that you can find in the Vilcanota Valley, and Machu Picchu is just a small part, which already make some problem perhaps from an organizational point of view. You have UNESCO, which is defining a site which is not independent, autonomous entity in itself. It's part of a broader organization. Okay. So it, in a sense, within INS Cusco, Machu Picchu is a small portion of the organization. Okay. And in terms of human resources, that is crazy. That is crazy. That's the country of Pompeii. That was in 2008. You have 2,751 person working in Machu Picchu. Amongst them, stable people, permanent position, are 123. That is totally, you know, from since 1991, for what we have been told, we read actually, the state is not hiring anyone since 1991. So people retire, people die, people move. So you have 123 persons that are on permanent post. And you have all, even, you know, even the architects, even the archaeologists that are hired on a project base, or if you go in the site at the beginning of the month, you see the people, workers, waiting for the job, for the monthly job. It seems to be another era, centuries ago. I mean, the waterfront, you know, where you get there and find a daily, or in this case, monthly job, which is crazy, totally crazy. You don't really need outsourcing here. You don't need flexibility. People are sleeping in the museum with a condition that no one will accept anywhere else in the world. So it's really something that, wow, it's a bit touching. But once again, it's really, I mean, it's not just the workers. Even the leading positions are in this kind of situation. We had our relationship with the director, and the secretary of the director was making a lot of pressure to us, please tell the boss that I'm working well with you, that I didn't make any trouble, that I solved all your problems, because she was waiting for the renewal of the yearly job. organizational aspects, autonomy. I mean, the rhetoric of autonomy is everywhere. And it's economica, financiera e amministrativa. But it's the autonomy of INS Cusco more than the Machu Picchu itself. And it's a very complex, INS Cusco is a very complex organization, taking care of all the, you know, the Cusco region was the capital of the Inca, and it's perhaps the richest region in Peru. So it's like having, taking care of Rome and Naples areas in the Roman period. So it's a very complicated kind of context. Financial resources. This is what is bizarre in this picture is that we construct it. We were able to prepare this table. People at UNESCO didn't have it. People at the World Bank. The World Bank is in parallel investing a lot of money on the Vilcanota Valley project. They didn't have it. They have no clear idea what the business model is. And we spend most of our time, a lot of our time in reconstructing. But it's funny to see how can you be UNESCO, how can you give money without imposing the organization to provide you data on financial inflows, outflows, financial report, and so on. So basically, you see here Machu Picchu, the entry is huge, 61 million, what is the US dollar, I guess. And see how it was increasing. That's astonishing. I mean, the trend, apart from the value itself, it's really, it's doubling in the last 2 years. It was already double in the previous 3 years. The Camino Inca is also, you know, that's a very delicate kind of natural environment, and to get so much money means that there are so many people there, maybe too much. So basically, this is the INSS Cusco financial report. There are other kind of money that come from other sites around Cusco City and the Vilcanota. So basically, these are the total amount of money that is collected. The 70% is kept by INSS Cusco, 15% is sent to the project of Inca Road. Inca, there's 13 kilometers of Inca Road that they are trying to develop as an international project, very complicated. Capacnac, 15% of this is sent to Lima for this national project, and 15% is kept at Cusco for the project. And now what is interesting here, you have to transfer to the municipalities this amount. And this is very crazy because the municipality is doing nothing for the site, if not, on the contrary, is making problem any time. But there was a very conflictual situation, and was on strike. They were blocking the road to the site against INSS Cusco, against the forest agency. So there was the municipality against them. So, and this is more or less how you spend money here, but it's first, I mean, it's a, how can you be an international agency so important in the life and development of this area and institution without knowing financial data? First. Second, when you see the amount of resources, it's really a bad sign of short-term maximization in the last years. It's really a question of the last, I would say, last 3-4 years at the time, 2008. And here also you see the trend in expenditure. And once again, it's interesting to note that investment are not showing the same trend as income. That basically is due to the fact that there was this new regulation and you had to prepare plans, and it took 2 years to get approved. So basically you were in a sort of takeoff between 2003-2004, getting a lot of money and new ideas for project of restoration, conservation. You were preparing projects, but projects were sent to Lima and waiting for 2 years and so on. So that's an explanation of this. So what is interesting in understanding the business model, it's almost totally self-funded organization, INSS Cusco as a whole, with increasing inflows, with some, like Pompeii, a bit of the presence of some sort of hard to spend syndrome, difficult in spending money, which a huge internal process of cross-subsidizing, where Machu Picchu is funding the rest of the system, which I think is rather acceptable. That happens all over the world, but 88% of the money is going elsewhere, and the same in terms of people. So you're funding resources, both in terms, in terms of both financial and human resources from Machu Picchu to the rest of the system. And here again, you have this huge problem of trade-off between exploitation and conservation at the local level and at the general level. You can use part of the money to exploit the other part of the valley, and you had also this kind of very unusual phenomenon of externalities. The Peru train were outsourced during the Fujimori period for 30 years. The hotel were outsourced for another 30 years at those conditions. Buses, again, were outsourced and so on. But just to give you an idea, to get in Machu, have you been in Machu Picchu? How many of you have been in Machu Picchu? Go to Machu Picchu, it's beautiful. And you pay $45 for the fee to get in, and you pay $100 for the train, 60 kilometers train. So can you think a bit of these numbers with 800,000 visitors? And what is the externality, what you give to outsourcing, what the gift to Fujimori friend, yes. And in parallel, just to think, to go to Pompeii, you spend $1 on the Circumvesuviana, and you spend €1, that's a bit different, and the ticket is €10. So that's the difference. I mean, I understand Machu Picchu is beautiful. I am happy to pay $45. I'm happy to pay $100. Unfortunately, I'm not paying to the people of Machu Picchu, but to the mafia of Fujimori. But if you think in terms of willingness to pay, in terms of international comparison, that's incredible, expensive site, of course, that cuts out totally local population, Peruvian. I mean, that's almost a half month salary to get in, if not more, and that's crazy. And of course, it's easy making money. You know, this kind of the business model, the break even is very easy. You have this sort of more than expensive Western prices and underdeveloped country kind of cost. So that's very easy. And you have these two plans. In this context, the Plan Maestros in 1998 and the Plan Maestro in 2005. At the beginning, the World Heritage UNESCO was requiring, UNESCO been very critical since, you can have a look on the UNESCO website. Is beautiful. You have this history of documents that I say that you have to do that within next year, and then the next year you have to do this, you have to do, and basically they were criticizing a lot of things, the lack of master plan first of all, and particularly the lack of a unit, of a management unit that were taking care as a whole. And this is something that you find very often in UNESCO. So, and then you have this master plan. And the first master plan, it's an internal master plan. It's a very, very quick, in a sense, master plan. For chapters, 90 pages. And it's a very, very, I would say, very trivial exercise from a methodological point of view. And in terms of content, was really exploitation. They were trying to think of building a cable car, so just to maximize the flow of tourism. They were, for a period, they were seriously thinking to get open 24 hours a day with three different termination for workers, fortunately for them. Come on. No, there no discussion at all on carrying capacity. Tomorrow, this morning we were talking about carrying capacity. No discussion at all on carrying capacity. And UNESCO was furious on that. They were, I mean, they've been on, with the telling them, we are going to put you on the list of sites in dangerous, and this bargaining political process that's taking place every year. It's a ritual, and Peruvians are really getting contacts and kind of political alliances. They are asking Chinese, vote with us, don't vote against. So it's really an international political game. It's crazy. And then we had in 2005 this new master plan, which is a very nice example of master plan. It was starting from the failure of the previous one that was criticized by UNESCO, and trying to follow UNESCO guidelines. And it's really a new, the master plan of the new era of post Fujimori. Fujimori, if I'm right, was when Fujimori fall was 1999, 2000, something like that. So the previous plan was still in the Fujimori era, and the new one is the new era. So, and it's a very nice, long, incredibly long and slow kind of master plan. And we were also trying to make some sort of comparing the, not just the content, but even the rhetoric of the two different plans in terms of structure, of way of arguing. And I mean, the what I like in this master plan is not trivial master plan in a sense. They are taking time to talk as archaeologists, amongst archaeologists, to archaeologists. This is a very slow description of the history of the importance. Yeah, it's a basically something written by archaeologists to archaeologists. And I like that. The old one was a very, in a sense, very textbook kind of approach, SWOT analysis, and there is not SWOT analysis here, but it is, in a sense, is in depth, is trying to address the issue from a curatorial, professional point of view, and there is a lot of detailed planning on resources and time and so on. And then they have the incredible plan, which is very detailed and with lots of different objectives and the different levels of objectives. First of all, in terms of conservation, then of using, and then there is a third one that I don't find anymore, that's not here. Huge expenditure over the period of 5 years. It's not very clear whether it's a 3 years plan or 5 years plan or 10 years plan. It's a plan, more or less. And here again, there is this institutional fragmentation. There is a total which is simply the sum of the expenditure of at least three different organizations. One INSA, Cusco, and then INRENA, and other Fuentes, World Bank, other special projects. It's a bit fragmented, as in the Pompeii case. But in a sense, they are trying to solve the problem. And also, I mean, it's a very detailed, and it's a, what is something that we really noticed, two things. First, talking with the people of UNESCO, they didn't have the plan. Talking with the people of World Bank, they had just an abstract, a short version of the plan, so they were not even understanding what those people were doing in terms of decision making. And we had a lot of meetings with a lot of different archaeologists, architects, and people working there. All of them were coming with their own copy of the plan and were really using it, going back to it. This kind of guideline was there. So in a sense, it was not a rhetorical exercise. It was really addressing the attention was really a tool that they were using. Interesting to know, I mean, there's a lot of, what is one of the problem is the lack of synthesis. So you have this incredible list of items and issues. Actually, there are three or four items that are taking a great deal of the expenditure of the investment that are forecast, and also in terms of time, there's a sort of concentration. So maybe one possible suggestion would have been keep it simpler, and try to adjust the attention on these two or three or four major issues and on the ears that are. I mean, the synthesis is not one of the best thing of this plan, but yes, it's a, in a sense, rather sophisticated. And it's totally changes in the way in which they are talking about the managing and of the two sites, or no, the two sites, in the two plans of the same sites. In the new plan, they are talking about a focusing on a professional dimension, and they are also, in a sense, making the point of the tourist interest and the sacred value of the site. I mean, it's not just a heritage natural site, it's also a sacred site from a point of view, and they are trying, in a sense, to address the issue. And it's funny, in terms of text, in terms of content, they never refer to Aguas Calientes, which is one of the problems that UNESCO is addressing most. You have to solve the problem, you regulate this hopeful city, you have to do something on that, and you have to do something on carrying capacity. So, now you can say, that's a nice plan, but so what? What are the impacts of the new nice plan? I mean, visitor continue to increase. The fact that you made a nice writing exercise in the end is not that relevant. And yes, there are several. Sorry, let me. There are several problems here. I mean, first, it takes time, especially when you have this kind of strange procedure under anti-corruption. It takes really time to have an impact of new decision. And of course, writing a plan and defining some strategies does not mean that you can overcome resistance by vested interest in the area. And the vested interests are really strong vested interests. But perhaps we have to wait a bit to see what was going to happen. But there are some inconsistency. I mean, when you read all this document, you see all the criticism by UNESCO are, in a sense, ignored as far as Aguas Calientes is concerned, or treated in a very, very ambiguous way concerning the issue of carrying capacity. But yes, this is an exercise, and is an exercise in progress. What we did find is the kind of professional use of this plan. I mean, if I were comparing Pompeii and the plan for Pompeii, I never saw any archaeologist in Pompeii with a bloody plan. Maybe because it was too big, those people were everywhere referring, in a sense, was really trusting this perception of change with that notion of change. And we have been invited by people, by a couple of archaeologists that was trying to address us very serious problem. Please take this into account. Please take this into account. So it was really, from a personal, I would say, but also from a professional point of view, very interesting to see the commitment of professional in that. And of course, if you think of what's there, what the kind of driving for this kind of change that we are looking at Pompeii, of course, there is this national need to fight anti-corruption, which can raise very serious problem. Without being too technical on Friday afternoon, all investment, all things that are considered as investment, are not charged to the income statement. They are treated as they were investment. So basically, as you were buying some assets. So it's not in the income statement, basically. So if you look at the income statement, because by law, what is a normal expenditure in an archaeological site is treated as investment, you will find a profit, revenues are double than cost. So you find 52% of profit is totally meaningless, and the financial statement totally lose their meaning. And if you look at the financial statement, you cannot say anything about the expenditure. In the meanwhile, I was talking with this crazy lady and the finance director. She was really problem. The kind of person that do not help you, to say the least. And after time and time that we were trying to have a meeting, trying to understand this crazy set of numbers. I mean, I've been doing this work for 25 years, and that was I never understood so little from a financial statement as in this time. And she were approaching me, say, "I have a question for you. How much would you evaluate this painting?" There was a painting in the office. I said, "Don't know, first. Who cares, second. I'm not here for..." No, because we are trying to give a value to our assets. They were thinking of putting the value of the assets of paintings. Are you going to sell a painting? No. So the value is zero, basically. Yeah, but we are also trying to put the value of the land on our financial statement. Come on. Be serious. Try to give us and to other people accounting data, financial data that are related to your business rather than waste your time on these kind of things. There is the other really strong drivers of change was really UNESCO. I mean, UNESCO is such a straight, I love it and I hate it. I mean, it's such a nice organization and such ineffective, it's so it's good and bad at the same time. There was a strong attack against the kind of exploitation. There was a question of ecological sustainable kind of approach to the site. They were able to stop the solution, some of the solution that they kept away and so on. And they were able to impose the use of planning. So UNESCO has been a real part. But if you look at the role that UNESCO had, it's in a sense a profit, absolutely positive contribution. It's in a sense, what I really perceive in Machu Picchu as anywhere else, was really giving voice to professional values. It's funny, there's some kind of asymmetric relationship. I mean, UNESCO is talking about Machu Picchu as a disaster. It's criticizing everywhere anywhere, anyone without distinction. And you find the archaeologists in Pompeii that are happy, because that's the only way they can resist first the Fujimori, but also the kind of maximizing attitude of the Ministry of Culture. So in a sense, they are the best friends of UNESCO are those that are criticized by UNESCO. So it's funny. And so good from that point of view, the positive contribution by UNESCO, but with very serious limitation, with this kind of macro approach, and without understanding institutional aspects, without understanding local organizational issues, and without missing at all a notion of responsibility. There, you know, it's so funny when you read all these documents by UNESCO, they were asking this kind of unidad de gestión, and there's a clear misunderstanding between the Anglo-Saxon world and the local administrative tradition. When an American or an Anglo-Saxon scholar is talking about unitary, that means something that has power, budget, legitimacy, things like that. The way Peruvian were reacting were simply having a sort of secondary level organization, a committee where the representative of the municipality in Reina and Cusco were sitting without any budget of the unit as such, but just bargaining and mediating what are the real allocation of power. That is everywhere. In Italy, Ravenna is a city with 8 UNESCO sites. It's impossible to get a bloody unitary master plan by the 8 UNESCO sites as a whole. Dolomite has been nominated natural site few months ago. There was already fighting between Cortina, between Belluno and Trento, who is going to chair this. China is full of example of these kind of things. UNESCO and World Bank are unable to understand the complexity of institutional setting at the local level. The Banco Interamericano de Desarrollo is much more clever from that point of view. I've been working on Quito, the historical center of Quito. The Banco Interamericano de Desarrollo was imposing the Ecuador government to set up a firm, a private law firm. Now, we are dealing with this firm. Whatever you do behind that, I don't care. It's your business. But we are dealing with one single firm. The World Bank has been lost the first 5 years of their intervention with Bill Canota in mediation with hundreds of different institutions, different municipalities along the Bill Canota Valley, the national representative, local representative. This is something that is so crucial. I mean, having someone who is in charge. I mean, and my understanding is those people do not even understand that the world can be different from what it is in Washington, D.C. The notion of accountability is alien, not just in Peru, it's alien in Italy, it's alien in, I would say, all over the world, apart from the U.S. and the U.K. So there is a administrative heritage that we tend to forget, which is so dangerous. I mean, if you don't know it, it will kill you. It will stop any possibility of change. And I guess I like the notion of unitary management. I love it. But it's something that is not in my country. And to be honest, 10 years ago, if you asked me 10 years ago, perhaps I would have said, it's a damn slow process, but sooner or later, Pompeii reform will get to its hand and will be more or less something similar to the British Museum and the one block rent. That perhaps would have been the answer 10 years ago. You ask me this question now, I think this convergence is more than questionable. The rest of the world has its own inertia. The administrative heritage is going on its own direction. And I guess either you are able to intercept this individual trajectory of change of public sector administrations in different countries, otherwise you will lose possibility of actual impact. And once again, it's strange. From one point of view, okay, we're talking about archaeology. So why should we talk so much about management? Talk as little as possible about management. But I guess these are some of the most complicated organizational and institutional situation I found myself in the last 25 years. I mean, it's really, it's like a bit like a British museum. You must be a hard management scholar to react to the arrogance of this kind of consultant. I mean, if you are an archaeologist with just few readings in easy to use management books, you will be killed. And this is also here. I mean, it's so challenging for me as a management scholar to understand the possible logic in there. It's so, and from that point of view, it's so surprising to see how UNESCO itself is so naive. World Bank itself is so naive. I mean, the research in China from this point of view, one of the two research in China, it's incredible. You have just to see the Great Wall. You think the Great Wall is one site, it's one organization. It's three organizations in three different parts of the Great Wall, which has no relationship between them. And that's it. And UNESCO don't even perceive this as a problem before. My suggestion is, dear UNESCO, have some thought about that, and in case put the need to have a unitary management, a unit of management, institutionally redefine unity as a precondition. Because if you don't do as a condition, you have no possibility to make a change after that. Ravenna 8 UNESCO sites are still working as separate entities, and will do forever, as well as the two provinces in the Dolomite, as well as the three in the. So, but yet, you know, it's in a sense, the problem are still there, and we were looking at the visitors data. It's funny because we got everything. I mean, we spend a lot of time. It's once again an issue of field research. You have to go there, you have to be accepted, you have to explain. You don't have to go as the people with the World Bank usually go, you know, when they have this mission and they go to five-star hotels where the local people go into the other hotel. But you staying there, I mean, we were able. I know we are so good, but we were able in 15 days getting financial data, which is not financial statement. Those are meaningless. That was internal data, something that World Bank was not able to get. Come on, that UNESCO was not able to get. Come on. Visitor data that UNESCO do not have. In our, you know, there's one of the rhetoric of the new plan is the carrying capacity, and this, all this rhetoric that we want to have less than 2,500 visitors per day maximum. And there is 25 pages on that. And it's interesting and funny. And you get there, you ask for visitor data, they give you visitor data, they give you visitor data for the year, for the month. And when you divide the months for the 30 days, you realize that the carrying capacity is much more than reached. I mean, more than it's not doubled, but it's overcome. So it's clear that there are lines that UNESCO is even unable to ask the information and to read the information that, that they get. There's a serious issue of carrying capacity, because UNESCO is 60 kind of kilometers far from any other places. The problem is that there's this crazy incentive mechanism. The people running the railway, the more they sell the ticket, the more they earn $100 time. So they are selling as much as possible. So then you get people at the front of the site. There's no way of sending them back, because the you know, formally they should book in advance, and there is the limit. But when you get there and the tourist, you know, that the guard will, or the accompanying person will call the tourist office in the town or the tourist office in Lima, and you know, the kind of pressure, they were in a very short period of time, the director of Machu Picchu will get a call, say you have to let them in. So that's crazy, and once again, in a sense, it's surprising how problems can be so easy to understand and so difficult to solve if you don't understand them. All the whole issue of regulating the flow of tourism, which is so crucial. And I remember when I was there and I was going to Machu Picchu, and was not planned very carefully in advance, and I had a friend of mine say, come on, be careful, because you won't be able to get in. Because from a formal point of view, there is all the procedure. You have to register, you have to apply, and if the number of visitors is already too high, you don't get it. But in Cusco, there are plenty of small offices that can bring you everywhere, anywhere, at any time you book, even the Inca rail and so on. So, such a complicated issue. Something is changing. Of course, it will be very difficult to expect that everything is changing. Unfortunately, after that, Machu Picchu was also became one of the Seven Wonders. So the additional pressure for tourism, of course. But what I think that's so interesting in this case, I mean, that of course, from a simplistic point of view, if you have, I mean, we have spent the first four lectures talking about the problem of museums getting out of money. Right? Now you get money. That's even worse. You know, and it's the possibility to, I'm exaggerating a bit too much. I mean, they were able to use the money to recover Machu Picchu, and they're still recovering Machu Picchu, the Vilcanota, and so on. But in a sense, there is the kind of pressure for exploitation, which is really so difficult to resist, especially if you don't have very clear-cut strategy at the beginning, and particularly if you're starting from a period where all the assets, the golden assets, have been outsourced for peanuts to outside. But we, I mean, if you, as soon as you were able, after the 30 years, it's done maybe in 5 to 10 years' time, you were able to internalize rather than outsourcing the railway, the buses, the hotel, that become a much easier solution from a public sector point of view. That would be very, re-internalizing all these huge rents that have been outsourced in that period. So, this is about Machu Picchu.
inventé la pregunta. Aparte, bueno, lo que he podido escuchar, aparte de que es difícil en estos países en vías de desarrollo, que es difícil enfrentar los problemas que se tienen, ¿no? Y aparte de las incoherencias que has encontrado, ¿podrías darnos una visión o algún tip para Machu Picchu, en el manejo de Machu Picchu? That's it.
There are two things. One is, you have a very good plan on a paper. Plans on the paper are irrelevant. So transform the plan in reality. I would suggest to simplify it a bit, to, you know, there is this kind of the need of talking about everything in all detail, so focus on some priorities, very, maybe simplify a bit, and that's one suggestion. But in my role, very rarely, in my role as a, sometimes as a consultant, sometimes as a external observer, I very rarely have to suggest strategies. I'm trying to suggest solutions for doing things that you already want to do. Better than I know the history and the problems of Machu Picchu. So don't wait for me to know what you have to do. You already have discussion, professional involvement on that. What I try to, I can help you in is just making things a bit more simple, a bit more consistent. In a sense, I can try to help you this way. So I'm not saying there's anything in particular that I could suggest to be done, unless to do what you say you want to do. And first. Second, I guess, I don't know to whom I should say that. I guess more to UNESCO, to the Lima government. You should try to understand the question by UNESCO of the unit of command, of having a unitary. And I guess from that point of view, I would suggest some institutional changes. I think you don't get out of this kind of mess without some institutional changes. Just for instance, if Machu Picchu were in Italy, sorry for this crazy, we have a ministry which is heritage and environment. So in Italy, that would be under one single ministry. And I can assure you that having one ministry or two ministries makes a difference. So one possible suggestion would be try to find some institutional solution. There's a question of governance here. If you don't want to reform your ministries, I understand that, but you have to find some strong institutional solution for that. It's not a question of putting together three conflicting entities on a table. It's trying to find one single table. It's trying to find, in a creative way, in terms of institutional, organizational solution, my suggestion would be try to understand each other. UNESCO is right in asking the management unit. The others are not understanding. Perhaps it's not just a question of setting up a unit. It's a more complicated institutional engineering issue. Look at your competitor, the World Bank, the competitor few meters away from you, the Banco Interamericano de Desarrollo. They're much more clever in understanding local masses. Why don't you set a private firm as is in Machu Picchu, as in Quito, or as is in this morning in Tuscany, in Siena, in Piombino, and let all the local bargaining processes behind that, and then you have the budget is given to that entity, particularly in the case of World Bank that is providing money. You have the power to say, I'm giving this money to that new entity that is under your control, the way you want, the CEO is up to you to define how, when, who, but this is the entity and this is run as a private law entity and this is the money and you have to spend it this way. So that's basically, I mean, there is this game that people are trying to, they talk a bit too much and talk about the some controversies without really addressing the issue. Then there is the issue of Aguas Calientes. Aguas Calientes is a real problem and you have to take the risk, you have to take. Now the issue, sorry, is not something that you can simply talk on the newspaper or you can talk or let scholars talking about. What is that, I guess that from an institutional point of view, is Lima government wishes to do with Aguas Calientes. I mean, that's a contradiction in terms. I mean, as far as you let this kind of short-term maximizing set of behavior, that will kill any possibility of preserving Machu Picchu. I mean, when Chinese will start moving as outsider, outside tourism, and you will get hundreds of millions, very soon, I mean, there are 80 million rich Chinese now. And UNESCO is a very sexy place. When you get millions of Chinese there, unless you are regulated, you really define this kind of thing, you will, I mean, there are some of these high quality, beautiful places that are really starting to be, in a sense, dropped out from the tour of high quality cultural tourism agency. I mean, if you go to if you go to Machu Picchu, you have this kind of traffic. You have to stop 5 minutes in a place, then you have to move, and people are trained to move you. I mean, you don't know, you don't go usually individually. Most of the people go by tour, and you are physically moved around. But if this is sacred places, I mean, if you go to Machu Picchu when there's no one, it's a mystic experience. I mean, it's a something that you, I mean, how can you do that in the 5 minutes with the flow of tourism? That's really killing. And this is something that also happening in China. I mean, this mass tourism is killing the possibility of different ways. You know, there's no possibility of that different segmentation. You mass, the mass tourist, which is passing Machu Picchu 25 minutes. And those that are interested and take care of the nature, the spirit, and you are simply passed by, covered by Chinese, by Japanese, by people running away, and that's so.
I was really struck by the number that you gave for how much it costs to go. $45, and that being half, if not more, of a local and monthly salary, if somebody has a salary. So I'm wondering if you could say something more about the the issue of cultural whose cultural heritage, cultural heritage for whom. I'm very curious whether either of those two reports mention anything about this incredible inequality issue of local people, for whom this is truly a sacred site, not being able to enter, much less enjoy, you know, experience it in the way that it was meant to be. It seems just a huge issue, not just for that site, but for so many sites.
And that's a growing, I mean, in this developing world with such rich sites, I mean, that's a common issue. It's a common issue in China as well. And I mean, here it's a, I mean, there is a talk about local communities, and there is some people living within the park, and there's a lot of work done by in the plan, addressed by the plan, and some sort of, you know, explaining the value of heritage of people living there. Not the, the people in much in Aguas Caliente, but within the area of the park, people, you can, of course, explain them, you can involve them, you can educate them, you can, but this is really a minor part, in a sense, is the is a local, you know, but people that are living in Cusco, for instance, they cannot go Machu Picchu anywhere. And people living in Lima, I mean, it's a very small elite of Peruvian that can afford that. Which is, so in a sense, there is no serious discussion on that. I mean, just, you know, the very simplest way of the local and the poor people living inside the area and the perimeter to be educated and so on. But the real issue of making access to Peruvian or to any kind of maybe even South Americans, I mean, it's not just a question of Peruvian, there is no any kind of policy of free days, you know, that could be a solution. I mean, it would be a bit mess, because then you have to have the free entrance but with the ticket, with the control of numbers, so would be a problem, but there are none of this. So it's really becoming, you know, $150. It's a lot of money, even for myself, if I had to pay. I mean, that's a nice part of being in research mission. So it was just my research funds. But I mean, if you are with your family, wow, it's becoming, if you have two kids and one wife, no more than one, perhaps, and it's $600. It's a lot of money, and you can do it if you are a Peruvian or a local. That's really, it's really a barrier to local to seriously intended local communities. And on the other hand, you have this kind of, you know, the issue itself of a local community is something that I think should be a bit problematized. I mean, it's another kind of, you know, the mainstream in archaeology, from what I understand. I mean, if the local community is Machu Picchu as well, if the local community is the mafia in Pompeii, or I'm not that much interested in local communities. So you should be very careful in defining that.
I would like to understand how UNESCO can see in local communities. In my country, we have 8 places like Mondial Heritage Culture. I'm from Syria. Mm-hmm. And already we have problems with UNESCO. Mm-hmm. For example, a lot of sites that we have, it's they are Mondial Heritage Culture. With the local community, they have problems, and very, very big problems. Mm-hmm. I mean, that local communities, they cannot build, and the UNESCO they cannot find the solution for them. What they can do if they don't have the solution and the government don't care about them, that very big problem. So I meet persons and I ask them about the sites, and they said we hate that site because we cannot, which that's a very big problem that we have maybe in all the world. I don't know if the situation is here like in Bureau or in other countries, but what we can do with these problems?
I don't know. It's a problem that you can find in many places, not necessarily true that you find everywhere. In one of the places in China, in particularly, I mean, there is the place where all the Chinese archaeologists took place in the last 80 years. I mean, it was a couple of years ago. It was a 80 years anniversary. There was such a huge controversies in these conferences between the people in charge of the sites and the local administration, and say people are getting poorer since we have established as a UNESCO site. I never found so direct conflict, but there are examples of this kind. Referring to Machu Picchu, as I was trying to say before, it's a bit more complex because it's not clear. I mean, unless you take a very ideological view of politically correctedness, of local communities are good, are we sure that Aguas Caliente people are the good? Are we sure that we should not rule in different way access and development of this terrible city, town, which is destroying the heritage, whether you should give regulation to access and to behavior inside before talking about local communities that are not local in any sense, but they are staying there for 2 or 3 years. They are not born there, moving there. So, and also, I mean, to be honest, I like the idea, of course, but on the other hand, I mean, who is local? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think that Pompeii is mine, as is yours, as of people in Pompeii themselves. So, I guess this kind of rhetoric of, I'm trying to be provocative, you know, just because we are too tired, otherwise we agree too much. But in a sense, I would like to not take for granted the old debate on local communities. I mean, there is a inner contradiction between local and humanity, human being as such. There is a potential contrast between local needs and rights and preservation needs, most of the time. I mean, I was talking with the word of the people of the local community, referring to the site in China. On the other hand, I could give you example where the local community are the worst enemy of the asset, that are short-term profit maximization. And this is one of the cases that I have in China. I mean, Lijiang village is a village that has been sold out for mass tourism, and 6 million visitors going there, and on the night having discos and karaoke in this small antique village. So, are you sure that's the way? And I was talking with those guys, and I was asking them, how do you make it possible? That was one of the criticisms of UNESCO, and they say, how you make possible, and the answer, what that was, socialist economy in China. The answer was shocking to me. That's the market. Come on, you have to regulate the market. We learned to regulate the market in the last centuries. So, and that was the local people that are profit maximizer, and the people at the province level, at the different views, and they are destroying the site. They are destroying, that local community is exploiting the site as they shouldn't. So, you know, just trying to don't take the issue of local community as a given. I mean, I would, you know, the kind of things that you cannot speak against. There are pros and cons, they are controversies. Even local communities could be the biggest enemies for the survival of the site. It just, you know, just, I don't like the kind of, you can't talk about that. Everyone is talking about your local community. Yes, of course. But be careful. I mean, it's a difficult contradiction. But maybe in most of the set you're referring to, you're right. But because everyone is always using the same blah blah, you know, the same mainstream. No one's talking about anything else than local community in archaeologists in the last decades. Come on. It's like, you know, it's like democracy. I mean, sometimes there's some complex professional issues in meanings, in understanding, in particularly if you take places where you don't have colonialist implication. So let's say in Pompeii or inside Italy without any problem of, you know, conquer or exploitation from outside. How can you have voice? How can you be stakeholder compared to the Similan Mami, the such a complex, interesting and completely difficult issue to deal with? There is, I think, in this kind of democratic reasoning we have, we risk to lose the role of professional elite. May I say that? I mean, I understand it's a bit provocative, but there is a reason why specialism is not an issue of democracy. So I would like to, I mean, perhaps it's better to stop here for this discussion, but I mean, it's just trying to, don't be too, yes, you're right, the local community is a crucial issue, but from time to time, try to problematize a bit.